Everyone follows the inclinations of his own nature. Propertius. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a new listener, welcome. And if you are a returning listener, of course, thank you so much. I appreciate all the support, and the show is continuing to see a very steady increase of downloads, and I really do thank you all for that. So, with all that sappy stuff out the way, let's go ahead and start this week's episode. We're going to be continuing and maybe finishing our focus on Sub-Saharan Africa between 6 and 4,000 BCE. To that end, we need to discuss the remaining peoples of the Ethiopian Highlands and Red Sea coast of the Horn of Africa, and people who are Cushitic language speakers, or Cushitic languages speakers, I guess. Now, much as I discussed when covering the Emotic peoples last week, these people are not isolated. With the desertification of the Sahara, they are beginning to have much more regular contact with the peoples to the west, associated with Nilo-Saharan languages, or the supposed Nilo-Saharan languages. And they have had contact with them before, but with the population explosions caused by the adoption of herd animals by both groups, and agriculture among peoples of the Horn, and proto-agriculture by some of the Nilotic peoples, of course, we'll only see these contacts expand and become more regular as time, of course, moves forward. And we've already talked about how these interactions are happening during this season around the Great Lakes and towards Chad, and indeed are probably happening at many points between Lake Chad and the Horn of Africa. Now, the most immediate macro impact of these interactions we'll have this season is the spread of the donkey and sorghum in Africa, and then, of course, into the Middle East after that. Though this diffusion may technically take place until this season is over, they will also and have been involved in spreading animals and other plants they received from Asia last season. Now, another group that they're interacting with, in addition to the Nilotic, Omotic, and hunter-gatherers in the south, like the Eburan material culture that we talked about last week, are peoples living along the Red Sea coast of not just Africa, but also the Arabian Peninsula as well. In fact, these links are possibly the deepest and longest running of the Cushitic peoples. Cushitic is the dominant language family of peoples living in the Horn of Africa, and it is a part of the Afro-Asiatic language family. There were other branches of this family all along the Red Sea coast in Africa and Arabia, and throughout the Nile Valley. Now, as I've mentioned in prior seasons, the Urheimat, or the homeland of Afro-Asiatic, or Proto-Afro-Asiatic, is debated. But Ethiopia, southern Arabia, the northern Nile River Valley, the southern Nile River, the Nile River Valley, and the Levant are all potential candidates for that language emerging, or where that language emerged, I should say. Now, my opinion on this has gone back and forth a couple of times. And I suppose in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter too much, because I believe it's a very similar path, but I think either the language began somewhere along the northern Nile River Valley, and some speakers moved into the Levant to the northwest, and they began to adopt some of the technologies of neighboring groups, or independently developed them, and then some members of this group migrated back into the Nile, and then Western Arabia, and then various other branches spread from there. Or it started in the Levant, and the previously talked about adoption or development happened of those new technologies, and then the speakers moved into said region, where the language would further develop. And by that I mean they moved from the Levant into the Nile, and then they spread out from there. As for the time frame, most literature and linguistics placed Afro-Asiatic as being, or Proto-Afro-Asiatic, excuse me, as being very old, possibly as old as 16,000 BC. And the absolute youngest I've seen it postulated as being is 10,000 BC. Now, by the start of this season, it's likely that various migration from wherever the homeland was has led to at least three, and four, if you count Omotic, sublanguage families emerging. Chadic, which we discussed in the Late Chad episode. Egyptian, or Ancient Egyptian, which we're going to talk about in the next couple of episodes, or in very soon occurring episodes, maybe not next week, we'll have to see. And lastly, Cushitic, which we're going to be talking about more in depth here in just a moment. Though I should mention that there are two other Afro-Asiatic language families that are going to emerge this season, at least in a proto-form. And of course, it's possible the tongues have already entered this stage just prior to this season's start. But a lot of the more recent literature I've read puts them emerging sometime between 6,000 and 5,000 BC. So, right, of course, in the middle of this season would be the absolute latest that they would emerge. And these are Semitic and Amizah or Berber languages. Those are two separate branches, Semitic and then the Amizah or Amizah, forgive my pronunciation of that, which is also known as the Berber languages. And of course, we'll be discussing those as well. Semitic once we get to the Middle East, and then Amizah and Berber, or Berber, I guess is a better way to play this, that we'll be talking about when we cover the rest of North Africa after we finish up with Egypt. Of course, now let's go ahead and continue talking about Cushitic, though. And as I mentioned, it was the dominant language family throughout the Horn of Africa, and indeed, it still is. Though I couldn't confirm that from thumbing through demographics. A lot of people in the region speak their various mother tongues, but they also speak Arabic as a second or third language in some situations. So it may not be there's not a particular Cushitic language, I think, that is more widespread than Arabic in the Horn. Though there are seven or eight subfamilies of Cushitic that have well over a million speakers. Those are Omotic, Somalian, Beja, Afar, Hadia, Sidama, and there's a couple of others, and I did not write them down. So forgive me, I do not mean to not cover those peoples. We'll talk about them more, of course. But it's very possible that, you know, there are only maybe one or two subfamilies of Cushitic at this point in this season. And of course, we're going to get into the specifics of those peoples in the future episodes. Probably not going to talk about it too much this week. But I did want to talk about the terminology when referring to Cushitic languages. We, of course, talked about Chadic being related to Lake Chad. But Cushitic is a little bit more debated, I suppose, in terms of its origin. And debated is probably not the right word. It's probably more of a... it's certainly more complicated. But Cush... or the Kingdom of Cush, the Land of Cush. Cushitic, of course, gets its name from that. Now, the origin of Cush is a little bit more mysterious. This is an Egyptian rendering of an endonym So it is what the Egyptians heard when they were speaking to people from a specific region. And we'll talk more about Kush specifically when we get to our talk about the Egyptian civilization, because Kush is a parallel civilization in southern Egypt, northern Sudan. And there's a lot of back and forth between these peoples. There's a lot of deep cultural links. There's also a lot of deep cultural animosity between these two peoples, regions, what have you. In fact, a lot of Egyptian, at least very early Egyptian writings, always refer to Kush as foul Kush or wicked Kush. And there's a number of reasons for that. We're going to get into it. It's possible that, again, this was a indigenous name that the Egyptians translated as Kush, but it may have been something that the locals had referred to as Kasu, or a Kes, maybe, is another option. It's a little bit debated because the Egyptians did not write down vowel sounds, so there's a little bit of guesswork involved if we don't have specific symbols that they use to kind of maybe help denote pronunciation, which they sometimes did depending on your script you're writing down with, but that's all stuff we're going to talk about when we get to the Egyptian language. But it's also important to note that Kush as a region does not always mean the same things to the Egyptians. It's certainly always referred to the land directly south of Egypt along the Nile. But there are times when that region was bigger, and there are times where that region is smaller. And there are maybe people who the Egyptians considered Kushites living to the south, but then there are other times when peoples who are not Kushites are living in the same region. And that's all stuff we're going to dive into, again, when we get to those historical periods. And, of course, we'll be talking about it in depth when we get to Egypt coming up in the next week or two. Apologies for the quick cut there. I was trying to deal with the louder sirens I'm sure you heard in the background. Another term that the Egyptians would use was Ta Seti, the land of the bow, which sometimes was part of Egypt itself, again, depending on the time period. And this meant the land of the bow. Sometimes it was called Ta Kintet or Hentet, which is like the frontier or borderland. And then in other times, it was referred to as Ta Nese or Nesi, which is the land of the black people. And we're going to talk about race and things like that about the Egyptians when we cover them, you know, in depth going forward the next couple of weeks, too. That's going to be something to talk about. This region you'll also sometimes see referred to as Nubia. That is thought to come from the Egyptian word for gold, nub. Gold was a very, of course, highly sought after material all throughout, pretty much all of history, but especially in the days of Egypt's strongest periods, gold would be a very powerful driving force and motivation for a lot of the Egyptian pharaohs. If you were to look at a map and see, you know, okay, well, this is Kush. Kush doesn't necessarily cover the Horn of Africa. So why are those languages referred to as Kushitic? Well, it's important to remember that, borders, as we've talked about very recently, are not hard and fast. There is probably a lot of overlap and migration between various groups living in the Horn of Africa, moving through the Nile, getting mixed up and mixed in with Nilo-Saharan people, And vice versa. You've probably got now as Heron's moving into the Horn, and things like that. So there's not a hard, fast border. And there are going to be periods, probably, that we don't have a lot of records of where the primary power in Kush or Nubia or what have you are Kushitic speakers. But then you're probably going to also have periods where the primary power is maybe more Nilotic peoples. This is something that, of course, we're going to have to kind of get in the weeds on when we get there. They did have a separate term for the Horn of Africa itself. It's theorized to be the Horn of Africa. But this is the land of Punt, or Pwene, or Pwenet is another reading. Again, we're not sure the exact pronunciation. And in fact, it's possible it could have been all those things at various times, depending on how the Egyptian language evolved. Another term they used for the region was Ta-Netjer, or Netjer, which means God's land. And this, of course, refers to the fact that it was one of the regions of the sun god. Essentially, it's in the direction that the sun rose, essentially. And there are a couple of other theories we will get to about this, being the land of the gods. There have been a number of theories on this. Though I should point out, Punt itself is probably a city-state or a small regional kingdom. It's not necessarily a land or a term for the whole region of the Horn of Africa. And in fact, it's not 100% sure if Punt was in the Horn of Africa. I think that's the general consensus today, but there are people who do doubt that. Some people think it's on the far side of the Horn of Africa, where modern-day Somalia is. And we know that there were city-states in those regions during the period that the Greeks were in contact and in control of Egypt, and then, of course, the Roman times, too. But we're not quite sure exactly where all of those city-states were. But there are going to be a number of city-states arising all throughout the Horn of Africa. And, of course, they'll be competing with each other for control of a number of different resources and the ability to trade those resources with outsiders, which is going to make them extremely, extremely wealthy and powerful. And again, we'll get into all of that. But I should go ahead and say some of the things that were being traded from this region. One of those is gold. This exists not just in Nubia along the southern Nile and the hills and mountains to the east and west of Egypt, but also in the Horn itself. They also have gold. Wood is going to be very important. Ebony wood, black wood, and of course resin, which you can harvest from different trees as well. Resin is going to be very important for sealing sealing boats and things like that. Ivory is very important trade good as well. And animals would be imported too. Exotic animals that the Egyptians did not necessarily have or maybe had a hard time getting or finding in their region. And it's not just the Egyptians who are trading with them. It's other Near Eastern peoples, too. People from Arabia, southern Arabia. Possibly early dates, possibly even Indians get to the region. Though that may not happen until later periods. I'm still kind of trying to get firm sources on that. But dates enter into the Horn from probably, again, either Arabia or the Nile Valley. Myrrh trees grow as well. So there are a number of important resources in the region that these people are cultivating and exploiting for their own use, of course, and then, you know, exploiting for export as well. There are a number of, not just Punt, but a number of other states or cities or kingdoms, what have you, that are believed to have been in the Horn of Africa region that we do not know firmly. Ophir, which is mentioned in the Bible, there are those that believe it is in the Horn of Africa. There's Tarshisha, or Shish, which is another place mentioned in the Bible. There are Greek sources who mention a number of city-states along kind of the outer rim of the Horn of Africa. These are Mundus, Malal, Avalites, Mosylon, Tave, Apone, Serapion. Now, these are Greek names, so take them with a grain of salt. That could just be what the Greeks referred to them as. It could be that these were not the names given by the peoples. But that's where, you know, not given by the people who lived there. The Greeks may have been making associations with their own mythological stories. But a number of those do take, are believed to have been, or have been discovered, as being on the outer rim of the Horn of Africa. And this is, again, today, Somalia, some of Etruria as well, though I think most of the ones I named are all Somalian. There are others that the Greeks mentioned, too. It's possible that there were more city-states that we just don't have a record of. Due to a number of factors in the modern world, archaeological research is very hard to do in Somalia safely because of, you know, a number of reasons, specifically the civil war in the region and just piracy and other things that are happening that make it very hard to really do in-depth discoveries. It's very possible that, you know, there may have been larger city-states that we just not have discovered. We know for a fact that large stone structures were built in Somalia. And this was something that was probably not done for like an individual's home or anything like that, but these were probably large-scale public works, either for defensive reasons. There's what's known as the Wargade Wall, which is in Wargade, Somaliland. And this was massive. The walls were like, they were 750 feet by 690 feet. And that's the high wall. So there were smaller walls as well. This is probably happening much later than this season, obviously. But it wouldn't surprise me if there were some groups living in Somalia that were building, you know, structures for, you know, what we would consider like a proper city-state. And they just haven't been excavated and found yet because, again, there's not a whole lot of excavation going on in Somalia. So, who knows, maybe in the future we will find that, oh, well, yeah, this place is pretty well populated, pretty metropolitan. Now, a lot of these places were abandoned during historical period after the Islamic era came about. And we'll get into the reasons for this later. But a lot of material in these wall structures were actually reused and recycled by people's kind of leaving the area. But we know they had pottery. We found unglazed pottery. So, you know, it's very rough, very rudimentary, but it is evidence that they either had developed pottery on their own or they had been trading with it from people from the Middle East or Northern or Western Africa. Just keep that in mind. Another big factor is the Somalians, or the Proto-Somalians, they had their own ships that they're sailing in the historical period. They are not just letting people come to them. Somalia has a very rich naval tradition. They're probably the best sailors in Africa that are at least sub-Saharan Africa. Carthaginians, of course, are ethnically Phoenician, but they are an African civilization. Maybe not originally African, but they, of course, dominated the Mediterranean Sea trade. But the Somalians had a fairly good share of the Red Sea, Indian Ocean trade for at least a period of time. They had these small, fast vessels. I think they're called Bedin. But again, this is all future stuff to worry about. But it would not surprise me to know that there were at least some small-scale journeys from early Somali sailors at this very early period as well. Though the travel between southern Arabia and the Horn of Africa was probably just in that very narrow strait. I forget, it's like the Strait of Grief between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. That's probably where most of that sailing is taking place at this very early period. So just keep that in mind. There are other sites as well that are not cosmopolitan in nature. They are, again, cave paintings, rock paintings, but we know that they are happening during this season. There's a site, La Asquil. They have some really good, beautiful rock art there. They actually have, you know, your standard white and red ochre paintings, but they also have some very nice light shades of blue mixed in, stuff that almost looks purple in some cases. But that's just because the iron got oxidized and it kind of has that dark burgundy. But there's some really great blue pigments kind of spread over the top of some of these. And this is a site that's occupied for a long period of time. I think the earliest it would have been used was in 5000, but it's in use to 2500, 2000 BCE. And these are peoples who are herders. They're nomadic. They are not participating in the agriculture that other groups are. They have a large kind of variety of things that they're covered there. They have cattle, they have drawings of humans, and camels too, which those are probably later periods, or maybe possibly, I guess they're depicting wild camels, but there's a number of caves in Somaliland that are being used at this time for rock art. We have this kind of mix of nomadic pastoralists, and I firmly believe that we're going to find evidence of at least some level of urbanization. Now, whether or not you would call these true cities, a la the Middle East, I don't know if I'd go that far, but they're probably similar to what the Egyptians have going on, where they have numerous small villages. But the houses that we've dated to this period, they're all still houses. They're kind of circular with kind of thatch-pointed conical roofs, and they are above the ground. They have these stilt legs, and they have like laddered steps to get up in them. These are common. Probably really good for coast if you have like flooding or rising water levels. Very, very practical for the area. So all things to keep in mind going forward. Seems like I was forgetting something. I'm going back through my notes here. With the name of the Cushitic languages. Cush is a character in the Bible. He is the oldest son of Ham, who was one of Noah's children. And he was the brother of Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan, which, if you're familiar with the biblical story of Noah, of course, Noah being the man who survived the flood, all of his descendants are the peoples, or the patriarchs of all the peoples who will repopulate the world. So, of course, Cush moved to the land of Cush, and that's why the land is named that, because it's named after this patriarch of the Cushites. And, of course, his brothers are patriarchs of other peoples and lands. Now, there are some who argue that Cush is actually not the patriarch of the land of Cush. Sorry for that. Audacity crashed. So, there are those that argue that Cush is not the patriarch of the Cushites, but he is actually the patriarch of the people who would found the city-state of Kish in Mesopotamia. So just bear that in mind. Though I don't know if I buy that, because he is a son of Ham. Ham is the kind of the patriarch of Egypt in this biblical telling of history. So it would make sense that his sons would go and populate areas around Egypt. Canaan, of course, is where modern-day Israel and Palestine are. So they're right beside Egypt, too. And Phut may also be the patriarch of the land of Punt, if you look at it that way. So just something to keep in mind. Though I think Phut is kind of considered not necessarily the... There are those that consider him like the patriarch of the Libyans. But that's again, one of those things that is heavily debated. At one point, people considered ancient Egyptian and like the languages all around the Nile, they called them Hemetic languages for the father of Cush and all those other people. But that is not a term that anyone uses, because it included a bunch of languages that were geographically related, but then once they actually, linguists got in and studied them and examined them, it included several languages that were not related to each other, at least directly. So that is a term you might see in very old sources, but those are, again, very... they're disproven at this point. So... just keep that in mind. But yeah, I think that is kind of a big point, or a good point to stop on. Yeah, so this is a kind of a decent place to call it for tonight. I do think we've kind of talked about the highlights that I have for the Horn of Africa, at least for this season. Hopefully next season we'll have a little bit more to dive into. I've been kind of reading up on the sources, and who knows, maybe they'll find more evidence, somewhere. Etruria, Ethiopia, maybe Somalia. I doubtful, but one can hope. For a number of reasons, not just archaeological or historical. Obviously, Somalia has had a very rough time of it since the end of the colonial period and all their civil war problems. But, not the best situation, and hopefully the people there can find some semblance of order and stability and maybe build a better life for their children, if not for themselves. So, thank you all for joining me. I know I rambled a little bit, but I do appreciate you all listening, joining me, just enjoying the show, and I hope you continue to do so. Please feel free to send me any feedback to war@revpod@gmail.com. You can reach out to me on X/Twitter. My DMs are open. You can comment on any of my YouTube videos. I do stream on YouTube live during the week, Monday through Thursday usually, and then occasionally on the weekends. Come by if you see I'm live and just chat, and if you have questions, you're more than welcome to ask them there. I always appreciate that. I hope you have all enjoyed, and I will see you all next week. Have a good rest of your day, a good rest of your week. Thank you all. Goodbye.